This is an Enterprise Times podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here with John Petrie, who's counsellor to the Group CISO at NTT Holding. John, good morning.
Good to see you, Ian. Glad to meet up again and have a conversation.
It's been a couple of years, hasn't it?
It has been a couple of years. Lots of changes since then. I am the counselor to the global CISO, as you indicated. I'm not a lawyer, so let's take that off the table right away. The counselor position is really a strategic advisor position in Japanese terms to the actual CISO. In Western terms, that might be considered a deputy CISO. My responsibility has been for the last several years the interface between the international businesses and the mothership. I work with all the CISOs of the multiple operating companies within NTT outside of domestic Japan. Everything from financial discussions to strategy to operational to incident reporting to threat intelligence, all of those topics I'm involved in discussions with. They do not report to me directly. Those CISOs report into the CEOs of those operating companies. However, they do have a direct line, although dotted, to the mothership, so they can express their concerns or desires through that channel. So that's my primary focus. Secondary to that is providing, obviously, strategic advice to the CISO of the holdings company. I'm responsible for identifying new technologies, investments, etc. as well. And I think, for the most part, it's a very, very unique job and, frankly, enjoyable. This job is unique compared to some of my other counterparts.
If one looks at NTT from the outside, it's not your traditional IT technology company. It's much more of an old-school conglomerate when you look at the varying businesses that it owns. That brings some very interesting challenges then in terms of how you must address cybersecurity. You're not looking at being an IBM or an HP where you're simply serving a given group of clients. You're also manufacturing stuff yourselves. You've also got businesses that are non-IT that sit within the portfolio. How do you begin to create a global CISO mentality across the business where it is coherent, where everybody's on the same page, but also where people have the freedom to act in the best interests of their business unit?
The very short answer to that is collaboration. I know that's sometimes an overused word, but in this particular case, you're absolutely right. NTT in U.S. terms or even in British terms would be like the old AT&T and British Telecom models early on in the 40s and 50s. Very hierarchical, very government-focused. NTT over the last decade has been changing that as much as they can as it relates to the hierarchical. But that serves a good purpose as well as a detractor. Let me talk about the good purpose first. There is a hierarchical advancement opportunity. The CISO currently is a Japanese gentleman, a senior executive by the name of Shinichi Yokohama. He is well known across the world in certainly UN terms and certainly global discussions of multinational corporations, very well respected. He sits in the current chair. Underneath that, we have multiple operating companies. Those large operating companies each have a CISO, as you identified. They report into their CEOs of those individual operating companies, so they run their own programs. Now, what is set for them is here's the basic parameters, the minimums. In the case of controls, for example, we'll set out a certain set of controls that are the minimum. And you address the diversity of our portfolio, for example, real estate, banking, insurance, R&D, telecoms. When you take a look at those business models and their strategies, they're completely different. CISOs and those operating companies need to be able to have some autonomy to serve their strategic direction. However, there is a set of controls, set of programs, a governance format that says here's the minimums. Generally speaking, we follow the NIST architecture from a standards perspective, and we set that tone. And then if, for example, financial services would be a good example, they would strengthen those controls a little bit differently because they have regulatory requirements and they have different country requirements. Their controls may be a little bit more stringent. Now, you might ask, or the audience might ask, why don't you put a full standard and make it as controlling as possible? businesses can't necessarily operate in that way. They must have a little bit of flexibility. However, if we use a standardized approach, we meet most of the objectives and limit our exposure. It's never about, are you going to get attacked? It's when. You have to reduce that risk as best as possible. The risk appetite for each company is also different. There may be some capabilities to absorb more risk than maybe our financial arm, which is certainly less risk. Our intellectual property, R&D, very protective. The controls there are much more stringent. Without releasing a lot of details of the program itself, I think it suffices to say that there's a good governance structure. Like any other major corporation, we're so big that there are some breakdowns periodically, but you reevaluate, reassess, and then you re-implement controls if you need to do that.
If we go back 6 years, outside of Japan, it was 120, 130 different operating units, most of them in technology, some of them not. Since then, we've seen two big moves to bring them together. The first consolidation was NTT Limited. The second consolidation that is now in play is NTT Data Inc., which the parent company bought back the public shares of in order to be able to use it as that vessel. But that means each of those units had its own policies, its own processes, its own approach. Consolidation is a hard thing to do. Consolidating that number of companies must have created an awful lot of stress points, an awful lot of potential fracture points. How did you set out, as effectively sitting at the top of this tree of CISOs, to bring your peers together and bring all these units into a coherency?
Let me talk to the CISOs that might be listening to this directly. It's about relationships. It's about understanding. It's about not being necessarily the smartest tool in the tool shed, but the ability to set a standard and a tone. Let's start out with that. Now let's talk a little bit about standardization. Standardization can be an Achilles heel, but it also can be a very good approach in the context of a transformation. And that's what you were really addressing, the transformation of all the international companies under a single entity. Having set a minimum baseline standard of controls, and it's a high standard. Our technology is state-of-the-art technology. The controls are identified. Each individual CISO, even though they were reporting their own program to their own CEOs of those operating companies, were all on the same standard, the same baseline. We brought these together on the security side specifically. Everybody talked the same taxonomy, everybody talked the same language, everybody was moving in the same direction. There was a couple of things. It's a real challenge to do this many companies. Some of the companies had technologies. They were meeting the minimum standards of, for example, you had to have an EDR solution. Let's use that as just an example. There were different EDR solutions. They weren't all the same solutions. Standardization is different than harmonization. We harmonized first. Everybody had to meet these minimum baseline standards. You could pick from a range of different solutions and controls based on your business. Now, the opportunity is we're going to have to harmonize that further and pick a certain technology for the larger good. There's a lot of things that go into account. Are you going to have cost savings? Are you going to be able to move those products within the solutions? How are you going to affect the business, the individual business? Now that you're one, that doesn't mean necessarily all of you are an IT company. We're a technology company, certainly, but that could mean different things in different sectors, different verticals. The consolidation was a multitude of integrations. On the security side, we started these discussions almost 2.5 years ago, even before they decided that they were going to buy back the shares. From a business perspective, the security teams have already been working on this forever under the leadership of a very good executive by the name of Steve Williams, who was designated as the NTT Data Inc. Global CISO. He sits in the chair for the new corporation. Under his leadership, along with all the other CISOs that fell underneath his leadership, they moved along that path and started planning several years ago. The good news is that we started thinking about, and I know this is overused as well, security by design. We really started with making sure that we had a standard, it was a minimum baseline, that we harmonized that standard. Now we're doing the individual integrations. Think of it as 30 or 40 individual integrations that have been going on right now to get to a single surface. And our assets are being harmonized, not standardized. I'm trying to be careful how we interchange those words, because they do mean something differently, at least in our environment.
7-8 years ago, when you and I first met, you were the CISO of NTT Security. You had a set of tools that the company had built itself. It was white labeling those tools to other business units, sometimes effectively, sometimes not so effectively, to be honest. But you were also selling tools from other vendors to those other business units. As you've gone through these various stages of standardization of tools, of harmonizing business units into a single large business unit outside of Japan, how much of that tooling is now homegrown? How much of that is brought in from outside? And how much freedom have you given the CISOs in the different business units that still exist to choose their own tools, providing they integrate with the core tools that you have deployed?
You always ask me the hard questions. Let me try to answer it as best I can. The autonomy is somewhat limited because we have a baseline standard. Any tool that somebody's going to bring into the toolkit has to meet that minimum baseline standard. It has to have the same security configuration, the same capabilities. Regardless of if you use the Microsoft security tools or CrowdStrike, it becomes a little bit immaterial because each tool has to perform to the baseline standards. That's the first thing. A lot of that was already harmonized. We've already taken care of that, and we've already set the standard of certain tools. For example, in our particular business now, from an identity perspective, we are standardized around Okta. Okta is our key pillar to zero trust. Zero trust is a long journey. You can't fill the gap with just a single thing. It's a lot of different things. But we've chosen that major pillar of our zero trust journey is identity. We've built everything so far around Okta. Other identity solutions were in play. And as we started making this consolidation, Steve Williams' team actually converted some of the other solutions, which I won't name, into Okta. Now that whole family of services and companies are all using that same identity platform. We use a lot of external partners, mostly in a strategic conversation with our partners. We both use them internally. We then have a part of our portfolio for go-to-market. Let's talk a little bit about go-to-market, because we do have our own solutions that we've created, our own services that we offer with our own technology. Where that applies or where the client might need something, we have solutions that may fit that client need. Do we use those internally? Yes, where it makes sense, just like every other thing. I'll use Microsoft as an example. Maybe my colleagues at Microsoft might disagree with this, but generally speaking, they try to use their own tool sets they go to market with internally, but not everything is internal. They are using other solution sets within their total package. We do the same thing. As a technology company, you don't necessarily have a technology that fits everything that you do or solves the problem of everything. In that regard, we try to do one of the principal things of being a purveyor of security for society. That's a big thing. What we try to do is, where it makes sense, we'll provide our own homegrown solutions. Where it doesn't, we'll put together services and solution offerings that will include other technologies that are on the outside of what we build ourselves.
When you're providing those solutions to customers, they'll already have other solutions and they may want to stay with those solutions. You may feel that your solutions and tools are better. How do you ensure that your integrations are accurate, are as close to real time, particularly when data and signaling is being moved, but also flexible enough to absorb what a customer insists on using, and sometimes what a new CISO into one of the business units might insist on bringing with them? Because when we all join a company in a senior role, we all have our favored tools and our favored ways of doing things, and we bring them with us.
The major pillars of our technology are pretty much standard. You're not going to move out of those. Even if you're a CISO in a diversified portfolio like we have, there's certain things that are standardized. Now, is there flexibility to move other tools, for example, some next generation tools that they might want to take a look at and test? Yes. Usually that's done in conjunction with the other CISOs. Now we're going to be consolidating that structure. Steve Williams is going to dictate for Data Inc. what that standard is going to be. And he's already set that from an architectural design perspective. But the individual CISOs or the individual verticals, threat, vulnerability management, etc., they may bring additional tools in that they want to use. Scanners, for example. There's 400 different kinds of scanners. How many do you want working in your environment? We want to limit that for a lot of reasons. It upsets how we do the signaling, etc. When a new technology is brought in, it's brought to the committee of members of Steve's organizational structure. He will take a look at it. They'll make an architectural decision. They might do a POC or a couple of tests, and then they'll make a decision on whether to bring that tool in. It also goes through an architectural review board. There's governance procedures that manage autonomy. You want to have flexibility for your CISOs because they have a lot of good ideas. There's a lot of smart people in our organization. They have to bring that up. Take that to the next level. Globally, where I sit, you've got the domestic operating companies, plus now this new big company. All of that goes to a committee. So when we introduce a new technology, for example, AI, another overused term, we're introducing AI. We've already brought to this committee, here's what we're looking at. Here's the kinds of technologies we're looking at. We're going to explore these. They give the thumbs up to say, hey, yes, go do that. So we're exploring different technologies, but we have not dictated what you can use. The other thing is some of the operating companies, AI, for example, again, are implementing certain solutions, or they might have said, we can't have AI functioning by itself. In other words, autonomous. So they've locked it down. That's not necessarily a good idea either. From a governance perspective, we're grappling with how we do that. It gives CISOs and the technical people the opportunity to bring tools to the party, but they have to go through a process of evaluation.
How do you adapt that for the different industry verticals? If we're talking about Data Inc. and we're looking at technology companies, creating an architecture, creating a set of tools, and creating a set of policies, processes, and governance, it's challenging, but there's a commonality of all of the business units in there. When you turn to banking, or you turn to real estate, or the non-tech businesses that you have, the types of attacks, the way they operate as a business, their engagement with their customers downstream will be very different. Those are all very, very different things that need different sets of tooling and different approaches, different ways of doing governance. How do you absorb those mechanisms into what everybody else is doing? Because there's learnings that can come from that. There will be alert markers that you will see when an attack is in play that you can learn from, and you can advise them when you see it in other territories. But how do you build a governance that is flexible enough to be able to move across industry verticals? Because if we look out there at tool companies, they struggle to make their tools work in so many different verticals.
Internally, that is a secret sauce. A lot of that has to do with the relationships that have been built over the last few years. It has a lot to do with the communications process and the discussion process. That's internal. External, go-to-market, for example. I have yet to know any security, call them business development people, that will go in a client and tell them, you're doing it absolutely wrong and this is the thing that's going to make everything work. Nobody does that in the security field. We listen to the client first. Now, we might position, for example, for us, we have a architectural design structure around identity. We will position that because it is working fabulously for us in our environment. But it may not work for a small business with 400 people. Small business may want to use something like a SailPoint or another solution, but we will give them the opportunity to review what our internal process. In my view, from a salesman perspective, we always want to be able to say, this is what we use internally successfully, and this is why, and be able to share that architectural design where we can. But as you said, individual verticals are different. So going into let's take a real estate store where there's still technology involved that's moving that business, but it's not necessarily the same technology as banking, although I will argue a little bit with you to say that a lot of things are changing. It's becoming more strict. I would prefer technologies to be on by default. Still, some companies have not gone to that process. They let the end user or the end client determine that. We're going to see more changes in that direction where you'll be security by default. In that case, we have a different set of objectives. What is that client's baseline standards? What do you have to meet? How is that going to affect you if you're regulated? What does the business model look like? Is it regional? Is it global? How does that work? And how do those security controls help enhance the business, to drive the business, to be an enabler, not a detractor? And that's a sales challenge. So the story is crafted based on client.
I'd like to change tack a little now and talk about the challenge for CISOs. When you and I last talked, we talked about how the CISO landscape was changing. We had technical CISOs who'd grown up through the IT landscape. We have business CISOs who came in and looked at it more from what the business need and supporting the business, not necessarily the technology part of the organization. But we also had those CISOs who were more of a business consultant. They were a friend to the board. In the last 2 to 3 years, we've seen a move to change what is required of a CISO. I don't mean in terms of necessarily their skill set, but in terms of certification. There are people looking at the finance industries and what happened after the big crashes we've had in the last 2-3 decades. We went out and we said, to be the head of a bank, you must have the following level of education, the following level of certification behind you. You must be able to prove a degree of competency. But many of the CISOs we have today, many of those people who are on their journey and don't necessarily think of themselves as becoming a CISO today, won't be thinking about that. They will have grandfathered in by being in perhaps the right place or even the wrong place at the right time, and the role has been handed to them. That doesn't make them bad people. It doesn't make them bad CISOs. When you look at this, what do we need to actually think about from their perspective in terms of mentoring them, in terms of what makes sense for them to know or not know? And how do we put value on experience? Because all I see at the moment is experience is being deprecated for pieces of paper.
When you and I were coming up through the system, we did things by the seat of our pants. We didn't have necessarily mentors to say, hey, you're going to do this. The reason I start out there is because from my career track and the evolution of myself, I have figured out that mentoring is absolutely essential. You talked about it already a little bit. We need to do a better job in mentoring. Every CISO today that's in their position needs to start mentoring other CISOs. So our younger people need to be given the secret sauce that's been developed through experience, not necessarily certifications. That's not a hit against certifications. But experience has extreme value in a lot of different areas. There are things that CISOs have to do today, and frankly, have had to do for a number of years now, that are experience-based. Relationship building, networking, understanding how technology really works because they've actually done it, but now it has to be applied in a business sense. Those are skill sets that are not necessarily learned in a classroom. Mentoring becomes really important. CISOs might be in a spot where they might be wanting to change jobs. There is a job opening, and that employer has got a checklist. And that checklist says, you're going to be in this position at a $20 million company. And you have to have a master's degree. You have to have these 5 certifications or equivalent certifications. You have to have this number of years experience in the field. You have to have held positions that are titled in this area. And that's what some of these businesses are doing. They're using this checklist. It used to be that every one of those items were offset by you can replace experience for those. That's not necessarily the case today. And I think that's what you're alluding to. The people that are in those areas have to take a little bit of time to decide. First of all, are they going to be in the roles that are going to require this level of education or certification? If so, then they should take action. And I know that's difficult, especially when you're in senior roles and you might have been in the business for 25 years, to go back to do a certification. And it's not necessarily at the top of your mind. Going to work on your master's degree probably isn't at the top of your mind either. But you need to recognize that if that company is going to look at you in that context without taking a look at your experience, you have to make a decision how you're going to deal with that. Companies also have some flexibility. Then it's based on the individual. And this is where I think there's not a lot of discussion in the hiring processes, where the individual CFO, CEO, CIO that are doing the hiring are having those interactions with that individual. They can gauge that experience in a multitude of contexts, relationship building, how they present to a board, those kinds of things. you don't necessarily go and look at a book to get those kinds of skills, and that comes through the discussion. I think you're right. Experience is being set aside for a checklist. CISOs coming up need to recognize that and need to take a look on how they want to gain those individual checklist items. But nothing beats experience, in my opinion. And having that discussion when you go into the hiring process with that hiring manager, I think, is absolutely essential.
But how much more complex is this? Because there's often no real definition of what the CISO role is. When we start to say this experience changes that degree, if we don't know what the role involves, what experience becomes relevant? In some ways, playing devil's advocate here, I think that's why we've drifted into this, let's have some formal qualifications in here and require the checklist rather than experience. What more do we need to do to effectively define the role of a CISO? You have dozens of CISOs below you. How do you begin to define those roles?
What are the minimum baselines, those roles? What are the requirements? How are the functions underneath those designed to enable the business? There is a place in that set of items that are the same for every single business. And then there's several things that are unique to a specific vertical or specific line of business. When we design a CISO role, we look at that from a business perspective. We will look to see, does this CISO have to have financial services experience? And maybe when we bring that person on board or when we bring them up through the ranks, they have that experience, and that then is taken into account when we design that role. Our position hiring is not a checklist. It is, here's some minimum things, but we take a look at that experience. Now, how do we go back a little ways in the history and bring back that priority of experience back into it? That's on us. Our profession has to make that decision. And we have to then move that over in the conversations with HR, in the conversation with executive hiring managers, whether that's the C-level or others, depending on how they're organized. We have to let them know that accounts for something. You're not going to hire a CEO that doesn't have business experience necessarily. In the startups, they might fall into that category by default, but you're not going to do that. They have a series of things, and then they have conversations, probably over dinner, probably over a glass of wine. We don't necessarily engage in that activity. Here I'm talking about the relationship and having that discussion. We can bring experience in those discussions, but it has to be part of the hiring process.
At the risk of upsetting some of your CISOs, in an organization the size of yours, there will be junior CISOs, there will be senior CISOs. There will be people who are moving towards becoming a CISO. And there will be a process by which they might be a potential CISO candidate. They will take over the role at a smaller business unit, and then maybe after a period of time they'll get experience and they'll move to a larger business unit. How do you go about doing that talent spotting for the people who are yet to become CISOs? And when you look at moving people to more senior CISO roles, and I do not mean to insult any of your CISOs, how do you then build that mentorship, growth, training program and get them to buy into it and commit to it so that they can grow?
It's about leadership. It's about relationships. And it's about understanding the individuals that are under your care to lead to the next level. First of all, a lunch is never just a lunch. A dinner is never just a dinner. A meeting is never just a meeting. There always is some other thing going on within that discussion. My team members know that when I'm having conversations, I'm listening. I'm trying to understand how they react. When I'm at board meetings, I will look how the CISOs present to board meetings. I will look at how they interact with vendors. Sometimes I will participate in the interview process or be a part of that interview process as one of the evaluators of an individual. Then, as a leader, I can provide them with recommendations of, hey, I think maybe this might have been the wrong way to handle this, or this might have been, and vice versa. They may come to me and say, hey, how should I handle this? What do you think I should do with this? In that context, it's a give and take and a way to explain how within our structure they should position themselves, or they should make changes in the way they might be executing. That's a large part of it. All of our CISOs have been CISOs somewhere else before. They have that level of experience. So the challenge then, to take that to the next step, is they should be doing the same thing with their senior leaders who aren't CISOs. If you want to be in this title, they need to be suggesting to them what those thoughts and requirements are. Maybe they're a little bit deficient in a specific technology that we have. The suggestion might be, hey, go learn a little bit more about that technology. That doesn't mean go get certified as a Cisco engineer. It means understanding the technology and be able to talk in a technological forum with other technologists about that. And then be able to then translate that into business terms, which is generally a lot of the problems between CISOs.
Now, you have an advantage that maybe a number of your peers don't have. You're a U.S. Marine Corps veteran. Therefore, you grew up working with men, educating people, bringing people into their role, making sure they understood their role and they were able to deliver that role, but also how you had to support them in their role. It's not a skill that is taught to a lot of business leaders these days. How much has that aided you in building your CISO growth program inside NTT? And what would you say to anybody in a large organization with multiple CISOs in business units who is thinking, what do I do to begin to build such a program?
That's probably longer than we have to talk about to give you that answer. First of all, a little correction, not necessarily my growth program. Do I influence the growth program? Yes, across multiple operating companies and globally, yes. Generally speaking, I would give the credit to leadership, to the individual CISOs, and the CISO of global NTT has a certain impact, how he handles and how he does things. In general terms, most of us are the same discussion. Where my, I don't know if it's unique, but within NTT it's unique, experience from a leadership perspective is about how to deal with people in life and death situations. It's not about a hierarchy, generally speaking. As we discussed many times, that general sitting in Northern Europe is not going to know what those four special ops people are doing in the dirt somewhere in Afghanistan, for example. So again, understanding what the individual needs are and be able to provide actionable guidance. Somebody asks me a question, I shouldn't sidestep it by saying, go see somebody else. What I should be able to do is give my opinion on that and perhaps suggest that they go talk to somebody else for a specific topic or subject matter. Then at some point assign mentorship and bring that level of leadership, because the appropriate word here, to that individual to start having them create their own values and traits to then take it to the next level for their people. It's a learning and maturity operation. Understanding individuals and how they work together is also important here. When I talk about team building, everybody does not have the same skill set, first of all. Second of all, everybody's not an expert in everything, although there's some people in our field that might say that, but they're not. When I take a look at a teaming environment at this level, you have people that have 20, 30 years experience in security, start off from the bottom, and they're now becoming CISOs, or they've been in a CISO role before, and now they're in a new CISO role. I need to understand what's their capabilities, what are the best traits, what are their best viewpoints, how do they view certain business models, do they understand what a business model is, all those, I need to know that, because when I put the team together, or when we do a program, I want to be able to put together the people that one person has a certain set of skills, another person has a certain set of skills, and I want to balance that so that they fit together. There is a harmony with those individual people, and that's how you build teams that are effective and proficient. And that doesn't mean you put a bunch of people that say yes to everything you say. Putting a bunch of people that can work together, that can express their individual actions and positions. At the end of the day, I also make sure people understand the final decision is going to be made. You might not get 100% of what you recommended, or you might disagree with the end result, but at the end of the day, we have to move on. In technology, you generally can't wait until you get to 100% solution. Generally speaking, an 80-20 rule, I think most people would agree with, you get as much consensus as possible. Somebody's going to have to make a decision. Otherwise, you never get to market. You never get to the end result. You never complete the task. That's one thing where you learn in the military, where somebody ultimately makes a decision. You take in the viewpoints. Now, when you're talking about, you know, military experience, these are split-second decisions. These are split-second discussions. What do you think, John? What do you think, Ted? What do you think, Mike? Okay, let's go. Not something that spends 6-7 months to make a decision on. In that regard, I look for the individuality. I look for people that make recommendations that are direct. I personally like directness. Some people don't like directness, but I think that's a valuable trait to have. That is probably one of my better traits or qualities.
One last question. We live in a time where change in technology is faster than at any point I can recall in my 40 years of being here. If you were sitting with your CISOs today and you had to give them three things that they need to focus on as priorities in their list, what would they be?
A very large question. The first thing, we're centralized in the Pacific region. Given geopolitics, we have certain things that we're very, very concerned about. Given that, one of the things that I've asked my colleagues to start thinking about is, what happens if the bad actors get their hands on the next generation of AI? Not ChatGPT. I'm talking about AI at the code level. And they get that and they start turning that around against us. And then add behavioral concepts into that. And then what happens when quantum comes along? Start thinking about how we're going to defend against that. What do we have to change internally to be able to recognize that? The U.S. CISA put out a thing called Living Off the Land, which is based on a specific attack attributed to the Chinese, about their tactics of using already existing tool sets. They've done their intelligence collection. They've done their reconnaissance. They've picked up on that. They're working through, and we're not detecting it with normal IOC kinds of things because it's our own stuff. That concept of behavior, not just thinking in one individual pathway, IOCs, I've asked them to start changing the thought process. Second thing is, given that we are a technology and we do have a lot of R&D, I've asked them to start taking a look and spending a little bit more time on what is the next generation of technology that we're looking at. Start reading about things that we're doing as NTT, like photonics, like ION, the optical wireless network, those kinds of things, and how, from a security perspective, we're going to protect those. We can maybe generate some technologies and products that will go the other way. And I want to make sure I stay away from indicating offensive actions, but I want to be able to preclude our adversaries from getting into our environments, our ecosystem. The third thing is as important as the first two is to be well-read. I'm not talking about well-read like go take a master's course. I'm talking about understanding cultural interactions. I'm talking about understanding your adversaries a bit more. They operate at different levels that maybe we as Westerners or maybe we as Americans in this particular case are different. You need to understand what those tactics are and how they use them. Just reading The Art of War is not necessarily going to fit that bill these days because they've changed the way they do things. Those are the top three. Probably have 6 or 7 more that I would consider as good advice for my CISOs. I think that generally will cover it.
John, it's always a pleasure. Thank you very much for talking with me.
All right, brother. Good to talk to you, and it's always wonderful to see you. Don't surprise me next time, though.